these countries are falling behind, and that is a global disgrace. We do need to do a better job in providing financial support for them, but it shouldn't come with a load of imperial advice and orders on how they should run their societies. We should leave it to them.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Paul Collier of the Blavatnik School at the University of Oxford, he's also a director of the IGC, has for many years delivered wide-ranging research and writing that often challenges the conventional wisdom of development economics. His work inspires us to think carefully and creatively about the real-world impact of policies, well, policies that maybe we take for granted. His new book is called Left Behind, and as the title suggests, it's about places that have fallen behind, whether they are countries or regions, and what we can do to help them recover. He joins me now, Paul. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thanks very much for inviting me on.
Paul, why is it important to think about development policy for left behind places rather than, well, what we usually do, which is think about left behind people?
Okay, so I think there are two reasons. One is that many economic policies like transport, housing, education are place-based policies. And so we need to focus on places because that's where the people are. But there's a deeper reason than that, and that is that humans are a very unusual species. We are the most sociable mammal of all the mammals. There's all sorts of evolutionary reasons why we've grown up so sociable, but that means that we live in place-based communities so that problems like loneliness and shame are place-based social phenomena. You, Tim, were just telling me you grew up in Scunthorpe. I grew up in Sheffield, and both of those are places that in Britain have drastically fallen behind and really feel it as a community. So it's a social phenomenon. And not only are we social in communities, but we work in place-based organizations. And sometimes our working day is spent happily in what you might call communities of work, like a good economics department in a university. Mm-hmm. But sometimes people are condemned to work very unhappily in the bottom end of hierarchies of humiliation. Imagine if instead of doing our jobs, we were working in an Amazon warehouse. Mm-hmm. And you know, enough about Amazon, I hope, to realize how Amazon treats its junior staff. And so people are routinely humiliated. Either way, most of us work in place-based organizations, whether it's an office or a shop or a factory or a university. So that's why we look at place.
In talking about being left behind, we've immediately slipped into the register that is very often how this conversation goes, which is about feeling being left behind. But as an economist, how do you define being left behind?
Okay, so I define it much more objectively than feelings, although feelings do come into it.
Yep.
We both know that because not only are we machines designed to analyze, we happen to be human beings, and that gives us a special insight, which we don't have if we're studying rats. But I measure left behind places and communities in the book in terms of one simple measure would be per capita income.
Mm-hmm.
So a community such as a country or region that's now much poorer relative to something that once was very similar.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you one example. 50 years ago, Zambia, which at the time was Africa's big copper exporting economy, Zambia was neck and neck in terms of per capita income with Latin America's big copper exporting economy, which was Chile. So there they were 50 years ago, per capita income the same. And if you or I 50 years ago had had to bet which one will grow faster, will it be Chile? Will it be Zambia? We'd probably have put our money on Zambia.
Yes.
Nobody would have put its money on Chile 50 years ago, actually. But now Chile is 15 times higher per capita income than Zambia. not 15%, 15 times. And so Chile has grown really pretty fast by any standards, very unequally, but pretty fast, whereas even by the pretty low standards of Southern Africa, Zambia has really grown very slowly. The difference between per capita income in Zambia and per capita income in Chile is just now spectacular. Life opportunities are just vastly different. That's a simple quantitative measure of left behind.
As with this example, you set out in the book the idea that becoming left behind isn't just starting poor and remaining poor, it's a trajectory.
Yeah.
And you lay some of the blame for this on the conventional economic wisdom around growth, and you admit that you used to teach this to undergraduates as well. Which ideas are you thinking about in particular?
The one that immediately comes to mind, I think, is market forces. Are market forces benign when a place is hit by some adverse shock, or are they malign? And it goes back to Milton Friedman's theory, and he had a little image to illustrate his theory, which was the image of a harp, the strings of a harp. And he imagined a shock to a place just like the plucking of a harp. What would the string do when you plucked it? It would wobble around for a bit, but it would quite rapidly go back to where it was. And that was his image for a complicated theory, which was a place gets hit by a shock. Sheffield, Scunthorpe, where you're from. Land prices, wages would fall in Scunthorpe. And so businesses would rush in and say, that's a wonderful market opportunity to set up a business. Labor's a bit cheaper. Profit is a bit cheaper. Land, in we go. And Scunthorpe very rapidly recovers. Except Friedman also had a theory for what happened if it didn't. And that was because there was suddenly something wrong with Scunthorpe. It was just the wrong side of the country, the wrong place, whatever. And the right answer will be, well, in that case, do what you did, Tim, get out of Scunthorpe. And any help that government would provide to Scunthorpe would be cruel because it would lull Scunthorpe people into the false perception that Scunthorpe would recover when, of course, it shouldn't recover. Now, you might notice that you've got a theory which cannot be disproved because if it does recover, you didn't need to do anything. And if it doesn't recover, well, you shouldn't. So it's an immaculate theory. It just happens to be wrong, I think. So I've got a little image, which is the alternative, which is of two dinghies in a gusty wind. And one of the dinghies is hit by a puff of wind and the other isn't. And the one that's hit by the puff of wind capsizes. And so now we've got one dinghy that's the right way up, one that's upside down. And in technical terms, we know, Tim, what to say about that. They're both locally stable equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
Like being upside down is very locally stable. Because unless you've been trained to flip it back up again, you're stuck. So this crew hasn't been trained. And so there they are, drifting backwards in the current. And the other crew is happily sailing away. So you now can play market forces, Tim. You didn't actually become an economist. You became a fund manager in the City of London, making your couple $100,000 a year out of putting pensioners' money into promising companies. And you can either put the money into the upside-down dinghy, which is drifting backwards, or you can put your money into the right-ways-up dinghy, which is sailing purposefully on. That's market forces for you. And, Tim, if you want your bonus this year, which dinghy are you going to put it in? Quite obviously, the one that stayed upright.
For our listeners around the world who've never been to the north of England, where Paul and I both grew up, him in Sheffield, me in Scunthorpe, they were both towns that were built on heavy industry, steelworking predominantly. And of course, as times changed and the steelworking industry became less globally competitive, the city of Sheffield and the town of Scunthorpe suffered and, to a great extent, have not recovered. We learn in development economics as well that there is a robust process called unconditional convergence that will, in the end, sort all of this out. Growth comes to everybody, and so therefore the left behindness is a temporary phenomenon. Students being taught that, are they being misled?
Yes, they are. The literature on unconditional convergence is just technically, unfortunately, wrong. I've not got the time to lay out why it is, but it's pretty unambiguous. And the best proof of that is if you roll the data on beyond the data used to measure unconditional convergence, which generally stops at around 2016 or so, if you roll it on to anything close to 2024 and you look at what are the poorest countries been doing, have they been catching up or have they been falling further behind? And my God, it's unambiguous. They are fast falling further behind. And in left behind, I measure that. I use the latest data from the World Bank and the IMF. We supplement that with data that measures investment, which might be a better predictor of growth possibilities. And if you use the investment data, it's even more pronounced that the poorest countries are just falling further and further behind. So we're actually in a world of divergence big time, not convergence.
This isn't just an argument that you're making about paradigms within economics, is it? You argue in the book that economics needs to listen to new ideas from other disciplines. You pick out social psychology, political science. What ideas are exciting you here that economics needs to listen to?
Yeah, social psychology is very exciting. Precisely because, remember, we're social animals. We're the most sociable mammal. And that is indeed why we've been so successful, because we've learned how to cooperate and learn from each other. If you're familiar with Joe Henrich's work, The Secret of Our Success and so forth, brilliant work on the evolutionary processes which have made humans such an unusual species, so much more advanced than any other species, so much more successful. But let's have a look at the social psychology of spiraling down. Let's go back to our two dinghies, one the right way up and one upside down. We know what caused it. If you remember, Tim, one was hit by a gust of wind and the other wasn't. They don't know that. And so the people in the upside down dinghy that's capsized, they look across at the dinghy that stayed upright and that's merrily sailing on and they are shivering in the water, drifting backwards. And they start to ask themselves, why did we capsize and not them? Now, we know the answer, puff of wind, right? They don't know that. Can they think of some other explanation? Was there a weak link in their crew? When we actually look at what happens, the social psychology of these upside-down dinghies or these battered towns like your Scunthorpe, my Sheffield, or any of these poor countries or poor regions that have fallen behind, what typically tends to happen is that they start to put blame within their own society. They say, some people in our society let us down. Typically, what they'll do is scapegoat some minority within their own community. It was immigrants, it was women, the workers blame the firms blame the workers. And that is the bitter reality. I was recently working in the Atlantic Caribbean region of Colombia, which is a fallen behind region in a very successful overall economy of Colombia.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Growing very fast. The Atlantic Caribbean hasn't. And sure enough, in Barranquilla, the main city, there's very, very vicious relationships between business and local government and between workers and firms. And so the region and the place has got a reputation amongst business elsewhere in Colombia. The workers in Barranquilla are very aggressive. They're not willing to work for the firm as a team player. They're always on strike and that sort of thing. And so that's an example of failure. Collective failure has turned in on itself and people blame each other for what's gone wrong.
If these ideas from social psychology, if they are scientific and they help to explain economic outcomes and processes, why aren't they part of economics already?
Economics suffers from two problems. One is it's reluctant to see itself as a social science. We feel that economic analysis, and it's a very simplistic economic analysis of individual people being greedy, lazy, and selfish, but it's a very unsophisticated view of human behavior. Then we then apply it to a range of social problems, family disputes. Becker comes up with a theory of rational economic man in a family. Haven't helped you if you try Becker's model in a family. and so on and so forth. So it's a very imperial subject. It's also very envious of physics. But we envy a very old-fashioned form of physics, which is basically Newtonian physics, the theory of gravity applied to an apple or to a planet. People are just sort of tiny billiard balls subject to exactly this same force of gravity wherever they are, and so behavior is completely predictable. No physicist believes that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I believed it for a century. Huh? Modern physics is quantum all the way down. I talk to world-class physicists. They can't believe that economics is so naive.
Mm-hmm.
If we'd only embraced quantum physics instead of classical physics, it would, in fact, have been very useful, because the heart of quantum physics is uncertainty. There's an irreducible unknowability in quantum physics. Unknowability, the concept of radical uncertainty, is very important in economics. I've embraced it because I co-author books and articles with John Kay, and John Kay is the co-author of Radical Uncertainty together with Mervyn King.
Mm-hmm.
They used to teach all the same junk that I used to teach, but Radical Uncertainty was a giant mea culpa by two supremely capable financial economists saying, whoops, and the world didn't like what we taught.
Paul, embracing quantum physics is easier said than done, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's because it's unknowable. It's a reducible unknowability. The other thing that we won't touch is political science. And political science is actually really quite important for economics, because it has a force, just like we depend upon the equivalent of gravity, which we think of as greed. What politics focuses on is power, political power. And they say, which social group in a society has captured political power, and how does it use it? Does it use it for growing the whole economy, or does it use it to enrich the group at the expense of other groups in the society? And the person who I think pioneered modern thinking on that was Tim Besley, who I work with a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim's point is that that really is very often a choice of societies. Do the powerful people want to grow the entire economy or enrich themselves at the expense of other groups? And it is a choice, because in order to do the former, to grow the whole economy, you have to some extent, tie your hands, limit your ability to be predatory on other groups. Otherwise, investors won't trust you. And so making that trade-off, some societies, the elite decides the best thing to do is plunder at the expense of other groups. An example of that, if we go back a bit in history, South Africa under apartheid was an example of one group, the Afrikaners, plundering the rest of society because they'd got the political power and they used it for their own advantage. And you can see the enormous advance of the Afrikaners relative to all other groups during the period when they held power. If we roll on a few years, we end up in South Africa with Zuma, who was the black equivalent, I think, of the Afrikaners, using power to enrich a patronage group at the expense of the whole. We're very lucky that Ramaphosa managed to oust him. So these are examples of where political power and its use, either use for good, the example of Seretse Khama in Botswana, the brilliant leader using political power for good, versus Zuma using political power for bad. These are really powerful economic forces, and it's crazy of economics to ignore them or to think that they aren't integral to what happens in an economy. You can't understand South Africa without understanding why its political leaders twice opted for patronage over growing the whole. You can't understand the success of Botswana without understanding why Seretse Khama chose to grow the whole rather than his own clan.
Paul, we've mentioned several of what you would consider to be left behind places. But the Copper Belt in Zambia, in a coastal region of Colombia, many people would really struggle to think of common factors between the two. In low and middle income countries, what sort of places are left behind? And what are the common attributes?
The common attributes that I see in the examples I draw in the book, and I don't want to insist that all left behind places are the same.
Right.
You know, you can be ingeniously different. You know, this is Anna Karenina argument that all happy families are much the same, but there's many different ways of being unhappy. And to an extent, that applies, I think, to countries as well. But I think what is common about the Copper Belt and Barranquilla, first, they both started with an adverse shock.
Mm-hmm.
Was then followed by a prolonged period of political neglect, because politically they were marginal. And so the adverse shock was never countered by public policy. There was just prolonged neglect. And then the social psychology twisted in and they started to spiral down because they blamed each other. Each group blamed other groups within the society. And that was common to the Copper Belt. It was common to Barranquilla. That downward spiral. There's also, I think, a commonality in how you get out of it. How to spiral up begins with agency, taking control of your own problem, recognizing that you've got to come together to solve this problem because nobody else is going to do it for you. But what's more, you've got one great advantage. You know it much more thoroughly than they do. What are the distinctive features of this place? If it's distinctive, we've always looked at those distinctive features as explaining why we're poor.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not reasons why we're poor. They're potential advantages. That's why I use the image of climbing up a spiral staircase. When you get to the top of the spiral staircase, you look down on the same scene, but with fresh eyes. You see the old scene, but with fresh perspectives. In Barranquilla, they start to look down and see, what have we got really distinctively? Well, because we were a poor city, we've always had a great infusion of outside ideas. We've always been incredibly open to the culture of the Caribbean. We have, believe it or not, the second biggest festival in the world. Now, that's a pretty big advantage in a lot of contexts. If you want to showcase stuff, having the second biggest festival in the whole world is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a teenage daughter, Tim, you will have heard of Shakira. I've got a teenage daughter, and so I know of Shakira very, very well. Guess where she grew up? She's from Barranquilla. She grew up there, poor, but able to party. Is Shakira potentially going to be able to help Barranquilla? Yes. You know, these are huge advantages if you play them right. Now, what's the advantage of the Copper Belt in Colombia? It's not Barranquilla's doing festivals, we'll do festivals. But they have got advantages. They've got to look at the place and think, what is our special advantage? And I'll tell you one, it's way up north. If you go a few miles further north, you're into Democratic Republic of the Congo, which isn't particularly democratic, isn't particularly a republic. It's quite disordered. Whereas Zambia has always been peaceful, the Copper Belt and its capital is a very stable place. And so you're on the border with a functioning city, and beyond you is the Wild West. And being in the safe border territory to a very big Wild West with a lot of money, but very frightened people earning a lot of money, that's a potential quite a big market. If you look at your society and say, in what respects are we distinctive? Can we turn those to advantage? And usually the answer is yes.
There is a problem in some societies that you point out that stops you climbing that staircase, though. It's what you term in the book learned helplessness. You pick out the problems for the population of Haiti. How do you learn helplessness, and what does this mean in terms of outcomes?
I've worked on Haiti a lot over the years. I love Haiti. I've got a lot of respect for Haitians. They're fantastic people. And when you take them out of Haiti, they do extremely well anywhere.
Mm.
But within Haiti, the political power structure has been such that they've never had a chance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a depressing history for over 200 years, being squashed first by France and then by the United States. Dictators fleecing the country, terrible record. So what have Haitians learnt? A sense that they're subject to very powerful forces over which they've no control. That's learned dependence. If we look at it in the political and economic sphere, at the moment they feel it's America that runs Haiti, not us. If you look at it in a much simpler sphere of a harvest or your health, these are chancy things. Maybe it rains, maybe it doesn't, maybe you get pests, maybe you don't. Same with health. You fall sick, you don't. Trying to generate a theory that explains chance events. Societies have been doing that for thousands of years. That's what gods were supposed to be doing. In Haiti, you have the theory of voodoo. If there's a bad harvest, it's because your neighbor has put a curse on you. And so that's two examples of, first, powerlessness in the face of economics and politics, and secondly, powerlessness in respect of fate and chance. Escaping these is hard. That's the trap into which learned dependence places you.
We better emphasize that your book's not primarily to describe the bad state of the world that we see here. It's to think about how neglected places can recover. You pick out two examples of places that were left behind, but that process is being reversed. Places that might not have been the first ones that many people think about. So first of all, Bangladesh. What's happening that's good in Bangladesh?
A lot. But one thing that isn't explaining Bangladesh's success is politics.
Right.
It's not political leadership, right? The political leadership is alternated between two rival dynasties that want to use power to benefit their own dynasty and the patronage network around it. So it's certainly not the politics. But if we look at the structure of society, here's a society that has really learned to work together. People who are very poor have learned habits of cooperation. And how have they done it? Thanks to two amazing local NGOs. These are not foreign NGOs that parachuted in. They're magnificent, locally bred NGOs. First, Muhammad Yunus Grameen Bank, and secondly, BRAC. BRAC is the biggest NGO in the world, and Yunus got the Nobel Peace Prize for his work. So he's an absolute phenomena, and between them, they've made it a much more cooperative society. That's part of it. And then on top of that, you've had one stroke of luck, which is a foreign garment firm blundering into Bangladesh, setting up, trying to make a success of doing business. And within a year, half of its workforce had quit, not because the conditions were awful, but because they said, well, we've now learned how to make garments, how to sell them, and we can operate very much better in this society than this foreign firm, because it doesn't know how to deal with the bureaucracy, and we do. Half the workforce quit. People set up their own firms, which fortunately it was very cheap to do. Sewing garment manufacture required very, very cheap and simple equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And so that got going at the bottom of the social ladder. The powerful elite, landowning dynasties, were at the top of the social pecking order, just didn't notice the growth of the little garment factories until it's too late. What the garment factories were doing were generating jobs after job after job, and some of those entrepreneurs became very popular locally in their town. And so some of those who were very popular decided, I'll stand for parliament. And before the dynasties realized it, there were a group of MPs in parliament who were the garment manufacturers. They became swing votes in the national parliament, And neither of the dynasties wanted to alienate them because they actually needed those votes to defeat the other dynasty. So it was a fascinating story that politically these guys gained influence and they didn't want very much. They said, we don't need money from you. All we want is to keep Bangladesh classified as a least developed country because that way we get privileged market access into US and European markets. And that's what the different governments delivered because it didn't cost them anything.
In the localism that is the real focus of what you're talking about, are you saying that it's important not to be too powerful? That might be something that's relevant for Muhammad Yunus now because the government wants to put him in prison.
The big theorist of that was Robert Bates, the great political scientist and Africanist, who described poverty as a political strategy to stay safe. I don't think we have to go that far in understanding Bangladesh. These guys became just sufficiently powerful to protect themselves from predatory behavior. And then in the process, by generating enormous amounts of jobs for young women, they inadvertently found that they changed gender power, that young women suddenly had an exit option other than becoming the servant of their mother-in-law. And that exit option really strengthened gender relations, which advanced enormously thanks to 4 million jobs for young women. That was a lucky break. Can we rely on it to work anywhere? We certainly can't rely upon foreign firms blundering in to try and set something up. And so it opens up the scope for active public policy to try and attract some sector that is an advantage. And that's known as industrial policy, but it doesn't have to be industry. It can be whatever sector. In the book, I give the example of how Rwanda broke into tourism, which is a very sophisticated strategy of persistence. And I think the big advantage of Rwanda was it didn't have natural resources. It didn't have a coast. And so they knew that they were going to have to be really ingenious and persistent. And it worked. It was an inspiring story. If starting where it was, Rwanda can become a big tourist center, then it suggests that approach of determination, coming together, persistence, ingenuity can be a very powerful force.
Paul, behind the Rwanda story, though, there was a political class who drove that forward. In other situations, there maybe aren't strong institutions who have that vision. Somaliland is another example that you describe of how positive momentum has been created. How is that created where there are not strong institutions? And how can outsiders help to sustain that process?
There's both bottom-up processes, as in Bangladesh, and top-down processes, as with Seretse Khama in Botswana. So if the message is get a good leader, well, there's not much that individuals can do.
No.
If a good leader happens to come along, great, right? But the Bangladesh story, I think, is feasible anywhere. And I give the example of a recent development in Bangladesh, which is the Youth Policy Forum, which is just two clever students who started this group. It's already got 30,000 followers each month. It's a very clever institution. It's also got thousands of young civil servants who are learning month by month how can Bangladesh become an upper-middle-income country.
Mm-hmm.
That's the question they're trying to answer collectively. And of course, those young civil servants in 10, 20 years will be very senior civil servants. And so time is on the side of bottom-up social processes. There's plenty of ways that you can turn the tide and catch up, whether bottom-up or top-down. The Somaliland story is interesting because Somaliland is an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
Utterly anomalous reasons, it's not recognized by the UN as a country, and so it cannot receive aid. So for 20 years, it's not had a penny of aid. It's actually done surprisingly well, because along with zero aid comes zero interference from outside. There's no foreign politicians flying in to give advice or preach what they should be doing or their moral codes and so on. The Somaliland population has been able to just get on with it organizing the society itself. And it's a clan-based society. It's a society where I very much approve of this feature. White hair is respected. Age is respected. Each clan has elders. Now, whether the young really respect the elders, I don't know, but they at least go along with the pretense of it. And so the elders for each clan came together, maybe 100 clans. Each clan nominated an elder, and that became, in effect, the Senate, the upper house. And then they thought, well, what sort of society do we want? And they decided, we used to be part of a Somalia, which was ruled by a ruthless dictator. Whatever we want, we don't want that. And so we don't want anybody to have too much power. We will get a president, but only once we've already got a lot of checks and balances that limit what power they can have. And so they ended up with a Senate, an elected Congress, as it were, and with an elected president, but with very powerful checks and balances so that each group, the president, the Senate, and the Congress, have the power of veto. And then they decided, well, we need an army, but we need a national army. Mm-hmm. At the moment, what we've got is 100 gangs. Each clan's got a gang. And so it's vital that we build a national army out of these gangs. But that means no gang should be in a position to control the army. The army is made up of every single clan, and there's officers from every single clan in the army, but you never get an army officer from Clan 1 organizing a load of soldiers from Clan 1. So the clan system disappears as soon as you get to the army. But the army cannot act against the interest of the president, the Senate. So, as it were, the army's there, and they spend half their national budget on the army because they recognize they live in a very dangerous society and they don't want violence. But the job of the army is to keep the peace. And they've succeeded. They are a peaceful country surrounded by a sea of violence. And that tells you something. There's a society which organized itself actually thanks to the fact that it had no outside interference. Now, it's still dirt poor. And so I'm not advocating Somalia as a model, but the lack of outside interference, I think, is a model. Mm-hmm. Of course, Somalia needed money, but what it needed was the international community to put up the money which they could then decide how to use. And that's, I think, where we need to end up. These countries are falling behind, and that is a global disgrace. We do need to do a better job in providing financial support for them, but it shouldn't come with a load of imperial advice and orders on how they should run their societies. We should leave it to them.
Well, very often books like this, the last third of the book is a sort of prescription for success. Here are 5 steps to stop yourself falling behind or to catch up. Doesn't seem like this book is like that. Is there an idea behind it, a recipe for how to solve these problems?
No, there isn't. And why? Because I believe that context matters. The context of a place at a time. And so the prescription of what to do in Barranquilla is going to be very different. Barranquilla in 2022 had a chance, get a giant festival going, bring Shakira in, you know, amongst other things. There was another very simple task that was feasible in Barranquilla. The port was silting up. That was an economic problem. They didn't know that across the Atlantic, in West Africa, a successful institutional model had been created, the Mara River Union, which should solve the problem of how do you get different political organizations that don't trust each other, how do you get them to work together? And the problem of the river silting up in Barranquilla was that all the way along the river, there were something like 22 local governments, and they didn't trust each other. And if they don't trust each other, no one of them finds it worthwhile to dredge. And so they needed an institution they didn't know about. I was able to say, just go and have a look at the Mano River screen. It works there. It'll probably work for you. Context matters. Time period matters. What worked in Barak here then is going to be very different from what worked in Rwanda with tourism or what worked with Seretse-Kame in Botswana. But the people who know about context and what's going on now is the local people, not foreigners. Local agency matters. It has to be people taking responsibility for their own fate, getting away from learned dependence. The people of this community and the political leaders in this community have agency. You can solve these problems, and only you can solve these problems. The book is, if you like, a menu of inspiring examples of often very unlikely places which have succeeded by taking agency and thinking about their actual advantages that they haven't spotted before and learning from others. So the most of the book is very hopeful. It's saying, you can do this, others have done it.
Many people would think that the lead role in this is played by the World Bank. It seems to be entirely the definition of their mission, or large aid donors, for example. Where do they fit into this picture you're painting?
The first thing they've got to learn is modesty. They are not going to save anywhere. Places are going to save themselves, or they're not going to be saved. No foreigner can save a country from itself.
Mm-hmm.
Until the Democratic Republic of the Congo actually comes together, either a bottom-up process or a top-down process, no amount of money coming in from outside will save it. Learn the modesty that we are not going to save them. They are going to do their own saving. Thank you very much. And if you listen to Africans or Central Asians or Latin Americans, they're not saying, please save us. They're often closer to, please stop trying to save us because you're so very bad at it. At some stage, there is irreducible need for judgment. Is the DRC at the moment in a state where if only the World Bank gave the DRC lots of money, it would be all right? Perhaps we might be a bit hesitant about that. Is Zambia now in a position where if you gave the government some money, it might use it well? I work with Zambia at the moment. I'm very impressed by the leadership there. But that's a judgment call. Will President Hichilema succeed? I don't know. He doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But it's worth giving him the benefit of the doubt. If the World Bank just said, here's a load of money for what you want to do, you use it, then gradually one of two things will become apparent. One thing that might become apparent is, oh dear, no, he got it wrong. Hichilema wasn't a great success. Okay, well, you put money in, you tried, and you learn, no, we're back to square one. We'll have to wait for another day. I don't think that would happen in Zambia, but I can't guarantee it. The other thing that might happen is that President Hichilema and his team uses the money well, and then what you do?
Mm-hmm.
You give them some more. You give them enough money until they've finished the job of catching up, which in Zambia will take at least a generation. Once you've made that judgment call, you can't go far wrong. You give them the benefit of the doubt for enough years that it becomes apparent either, yes, this is working, give them more, or no, it was worth a shot, but this time it didn't work. Sometime in the future, Zambia's going to catch up for sure. And so we just wait for an opportunity to come along. What's disgraceful is missing an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I used to work with David Cameron on this, and he's a very clever man, a thoughtful man. He said, look, if we can get five situations that might be promising and two turn out to be good, it's so much better to waste a bit of money on the three that weren't. How long has Zambia waited to get to a genuine opportunity? Remember, it's been falling behind for 50 years. We don't want to miss an opportunity that comes through once every 50, once every 30 years. That's the judgment call that places like the World Bank and the IMF should be taking. And they don't.
What about the flip side of this, though? example, you've said that many of these problems come about because of bad leadership, corruption, bad institutions. What about the coercive power of these large donors to be able to say, you'll get this, but if you do things in the way that we would prefer, is that a force for good?
I think our record on that is frankly abysmal. And I give examples in the book, example after example. My God, it's painful reading. And it's so embarrassing how bad we've been at these interventions. Our appetite for telling others what to do seems to have gone up with our own incompetence in running our own societies. I think a period of restraint would be quite appropriate. Maybe we'll learn that there are moments when we should intervene. I'm sure the appetite for intervention will recover, but just for the moment, let's try a period of standing back from telling people all the wise things that they ought to do. I think the International Growth Center has actually got it right. If only the World Bank could just learn from the International Growth Center, you'd split off the research and advice part of the bank from the money part of the bank. I used to direct the research department of the World Bank, so I know from the inside. It's had some very good people on the research side providing research and advice, but unfortunately, that was saddled with the business of linking it to money, and that's where conditionality comes in. The temptation to force people to do what you think becomes overwhelming. And as I say, our record is so bad, we just need a phase where we resist that temptation.
Final question then, Paul. You've been involved with research all your life, and VoxDev is all about that pipeline from research to policy. What research do we need? How does that research then get implemented in these contexts that you're talking about?
As far as possible, the research needs to be done in country. Precisely because all these contexts are different. And so one of the things the IGC specializes in is encouraging field research in country, co-generated with the government. I think it's very important that as far as possible, the research is co-generated. Because then if the government itself shapes and co-owns that research, it's much, much more likely to stay interested and actually apply the results. People are very reluctant to apply knowledge that they haven't themselves generated. I work a lot with NGOs, and my challenge to NGOs is to show me an example of one NGO which has learnt anything from another NGO. Show me a project which you have implemented because you've learnt it from another NGO. I have never had a single example. So the foreign NGO community is not a good set of organizations learning from each other. They're much closer to the fashion industry, where you've got to be this year's fashion and you've got to be at the forefront. You're all competitors. The IGC model of in-country co-generated research is much, much more likely in the end to prove lasting and endurable policy change.
Paul, we could talk for another hour about this. I hope that soon we will, but for now, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The book is called Left Behind, A New Economics for Neglected Places. The author, of course, Paul Collier. It's published by Penguin. This has been a VoxDev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Please remember to review and rate and share our episodes, because then more people can get to hear conversations like this.